everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast.
Where two Catholics talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
Yeah. And this is episode number 55.
Oh.
And we're going to talk about Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler.
Indeed we are.
Yeah, yeah. So we did The Godfather last time, and now we're doing Parable of the Sower. Two very, very happy pieces of work.
Scott,
which is
you,
which is weird.
Were you feeling real sad when you chose these or something?
I'm not sure. You know, and then reading this one at a time when I feel so happy, you know, about everything that's going on with the new Pope and everything,
mm-hmm.
It was not the right mood.
Oh.
Yeah.
You were so joyful or excited or hopeful this was not meshing right.
It was pulling me the other direction. Yeah,
it's not a happy book. It's not a happy book.
Yeah, yeah. But I did like the book, and I do love our new Pope.
Hey, me too.
Yes, Pope Francis.
He's so different, though.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Different is good.
Well, I don't know if it's good. It's just what it is.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The thing that I think is interesting is some people are having a lot of trouble with it. You know, you'll see people on blogs talking about, but he's not wearing the red shoes. It's a slap at Pope Benedict. It's like, no, he just doesn't want the red shoes. It's just he's different.
I really haven't read any of that kind of thing.
I've just
pretty much been, you know, like you say, go to the source and reading what he says and watching him. He seems to be a very happy guy. Seems to be a very spiritual guy.
Very genuine.
Yeah.
Francis of Assisi is who he chose his name for. Mm-hmm. And that's very, to a Catholic anyway, the minute I heard that name, I was like, oh my gosh, I don't think there's been another Francis. And there hadn't. That's a hugely significant name. That's the saint who was told by God, rebuild my church. And he's also the saint who, I think he's the first saint who got the stigmata.
Mm.
And he also is the person who gave us the nativity scene. So, among other things, among loving nature. So I guess that's good for a mesh with this.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it sure is. I've got a few books on my reading list.
Do you?
Yeah, Francis of Assisi by G.K. Chesterton is in my stack.
Okay.
I want to reread that. I've read it before.
Okay.
And I want to read The Jesuit Guide to Nearly Everything by James Martin.
I've wanted to read that for some time.
Yeah,
yes.
So I've got that one in my stack. And then I sent him a tweet and I said, hey, what's a good history of the Jesuits? Because I found a book on the Jesuits by Malachi Martin, who is kind of out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Kurt Jester, I said, hey, is this is he someone I want to read? And he says, well, he's out there. So
I don't want to put words
in his mouth, but I don't believe he was recommending that particular book. So I asked Father Martin on Twitter, I said, what's a good history? And then he answered me and he said, The First Jesuits by a fellow named O'Malley.
Oh, I've heard of that book. And in fact, maybe either from him, you know, seeing him write something or just maybe he recommended it, you know, did a blurb for it. But I think I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, yeah. So I got that ordered. Didn't have a Kindle version or anything. It must be an older book. So I've got a copy on the way, though.
Well, and what's funny, if you're not Catholic or if you're a new Catholic or our poor RCIA class, they're here. I mean, and this for non-Catholics, those are the people who are taking the classes, so they'll enter the church at Easter. And one person, our priest was there last time, and one person said, so people are saying he's a Jesuit as if that's a bad thing. I don't know why. Does anybody care? And everybody who had been around that kind of talk just started laughing. And Father LeBone said, well, there's two kinds of Jesuits. There's the really, really, really great Jesuits. And then there's the ones that are more like the bad fruit on the tree. And you're just like, I don't know how you explain that.
Wow, kind of like everything, huh?
Yeah, exactly. But I think the Jesuits went through a period where because they're teachers and because they question and they're very influential, when they're bad, I think it shows more.
Probably so.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But this guy seems really great, really down to earth, really genuine. I don't know if you saw that video of him stopping the Pope Mobile today. And
yeah, I sure did.
Making them let him out so he could bless that very, I was going to say sick, but it wasn't sick.
Disabled guy.
Thank you. It was a D word. And I was like, it's not deranged. What's a word like that? Disabled guy.
Mm-hmm.
That was really touching.
It was, so. Yeah. Yeah, he's got to be driving those security guards just crazy. Those stories are interesting. I pray for his safety. I hope he remains safe, of course. But it's really something to see him just doing that kind of thing. A story I read, he went to a church, a Marian shrine, that morning after he became Pope, and he told the security guys he wanted to leave the church open. He just wanted to be one of them, one of the pilgrims. But the security guards said, I don't think you should do that. So they went ahead and they closed the church.
Yeah.
And then they reopened it, rent, and he was done. But then he went outside.
And, I'm just going to walk to the hotel or whatever.
Right after, that was a funny thing. Right after he got elected, it was that night. Didn't he go back to that hotel in the bus with the rest of the cardinals, you know, everybody in black, and there's the Pope in white.
And, going to settle his bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something else. Yeah.
Well, and they'll work it all out one way or the other. But, you know, I was thinking about that because I told you in an email today, I was listening to something about the early martyrs of the church, and they were fearless.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, within reason, they didn't go around going, I am a Christian, because you would get hauled away during certain time periods, but they would do those kind of things that Pope Francis is doing.
Yeah,
you know, they took in the plague victims when everyone was running away. They'd pick up all the little abandoned baby girls and raise them. And, you know, they were out there for everyone.
Yeah.
So this is a good thing, I think. I like it.
I like it so far, too.
Yeah.
I think it's refreshing. It's, you know, I love Pope Emeritus Benedict.
Mm-hmm.
Wish him very well. Man. And then I have no ill whatsoever to say about him, but This is really an interesting thing that's going on right now. Very.
Well, I just think we are being shown, you know, Christ expresses himself through different people in so many different ways. Hmm. And there's the scholarly, gentle way that teaches. That's Benedict, who did so many other things too. And then you've got Francis, who's, my gosh, the man has been going head to head with the Argentinian government for how long?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he understands dealing with people in power, but he also understands what it does to the real person who's, you know, a victim. So I think it's going to be really interesting.
I think so too.
Yeah. And so against that, we have this book, which I really liked this book. I can't remember if I said that already, but I really did.
I'm glad that you did.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was kind of afraid of it. I'm just going to say, because I read about Octavia Butler on the back jacket and it said, as one of the only black women writing science fiction, that was fine. She has received widespread praise for her exploration of feminist and racial themes. And I went, oh, great.
Oh, no.
I don't really like to read those books that were with a real particular point. But this one, those things are in there, I suppose, but they're just part of the story itself.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so she did a really great job.
Yeah, and I've read this book and the Parable of the Talents, which is the sequel.
Oh, okay.
And she was going to write one called Parable of the Trickster.
Oh,
that was
going to
be the third piece, but did not get it done before she died, unfortunately. And I've read a lot of short fiction that she's written that I've really enjoyed.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's very different.
I'll have to... Well,
she doesn't write a lot of short fiction, but what she wrote was really superior, in my opinion.
I have to say, she's interesting because I know she wrote science fiction pretty much exclusively, it seems like, from the list of books I saw. But she doesn't seem like she thinks she's writing science fiction. She's just writing, and she's just a good writer.
Yeah,
the way she expresses herself is really... very much in a hard science fiction sort of a way, in terms of, here's this really interesting idea. Where is it taking me? What are the stories of the people? I mean, I thought that was really good.
Yeah. And my understanding of her from what I've read is that she doesn't shy away from that label either. You know, mm-hmm. for someone to call her a science fiction writer is not an insult, as it is yeah. to a lot of writers who really are writing science fiction, but they want to be mainstream writers. They don't want to be science yeah. fiction writers, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, you kind of get the idea. She didn't worry about those kind of labels.
Yeah, yeah.
She'd let people just put her wherever that was because she was, and I don't know. I don't know anything about her, but from this book, she seemed pretty self-confident because, of course, I was kind of reading Lauren as her
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Yeah, and that's probably
expressing yeah, a lot of things that the few things I did know about her from the back, those were things that Lauren was making comments on or expressing herself about too.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, do you want to tell the story really quick?
Yeah, I was just going to point. I read a short story of hers called Speech Sounds, which kind of felt like the same world as this book. Mm-hmm. Although there was kind of a different strange thing going on in Speech Sounds. But what was interesting about that, it was also kind of a post-apocalyptic thing. Mm-hmm. Yet some of the society was still running, which is exactly what was going right. on in this book. You know, you had these enclaves of walled communities, and the president was still there. And there was someone going to Mars in a spaceship, you know, that had nothing to do with the story. This is with, like, things she was seeing on the news.
Yeah.
So society was crumbling, but it wasn't like a bomb had gone off. It was just kind of, you know, if some of these trends just keep going, this is kind of an extreme of where we're headed type of a thing. And she said something that was interesting. She said that the Speech Sounds story, she wrote an afterword to it in the book I have. Ooh. And she said that this story was conceived in weariness, depression, and sorrow. I began the story feeling little hope or liking for the human species, but by the time I reached the end of it, my hope had come back. It always seems to do that. Hmm. And then she went on to describe how she was on a bus, and these two men got in an argument on the bus. The bus is crowded, and everybody, you know, who's not part of this argument is, you know, trying to kind of get away, and one of the guys decides that it's time for him to leave, but the other guy wouldn't let him leave. They ended up fighting, so right here on this bus, right in front mm-hmm. of her. And that's when she was like, you know, I just don't have much hope. And mm-hmm. then she writes a story, and it kind of, by the end of the story, which is also tragic, just like this one is, you know, she kind of brings it to the end and then ends up with some hope. Now, I'm not sure if this one really does that. This one... It was interesting to me when I guess it did because they got somewhere, but I realize I'm jumping towards the ending, but it felt to me as I was reading it the second time,
mm-hmm.
I kept expecting, you know, because I had read it long enough ago that I didn't have all the details. I don't remember all the details, but there was no real climactic event.
In this book?
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that there was? It's not like it petered out. It's like they arrived. So the story was kind of a journey somewhere. And when they arrived there and she set up her community, that was the end. But I was expecting, oh, geez, something tragic's going to happen. And it didn't. And yeah. I guess maybe that's the hope at the end.
Well, and that's... maybe I'm jumping too far ahead if I say that to me was kind of indicative of the entire journey.
Yeah, and that's probably so.
Mm-hmm. Should I talk about that now?
Yeah, go right ahead. I mean, I'll get into it here, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, because basically, as you said, let me just really quick get us there, is most normal neighborhoods or what used to be normal neighborhoods have got a wall around them, and then they're called neighborhoods with a capital N because they're the only little areas of normalcy left. Mm-hmm. You still have to pay taxes. I was shocked. You still have, like, for what? Because you have to pay the police to show up, and they might not find anything out for 2 or 3 days. And then, too bad, you've still paid them. You have to pay the firemen to come. You have to have your own guards on the walls, that kind of thing. But outside of those walls is complete barbarism, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Except for we find out later there's some areas like stores and things that aren't that right. way. And people mm-hmm. will go out of there in groups to go to work. I don't know exactly where, I guess to other protected places. But the story that we're told at the beginning, or the first half of the book at least, is Lauren Olamina, who's growing up in one of these communities, and her father's fairly influential, and he's a Baptist minister, and she's got several brothers and sisters and a stepmother.
Yeah. And the book was written in 1993. It's about a time in 2024. She was 15 when the book opened. So the book spans about 3 years. So she's 18 when it ends.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause 2024, I was like, oh, cause they talk about, well, back in, you know, like 2013, which is still future of where the 1993 writing date was, but it's backwards in time for them. And I'm thinking, oh, thank goodness that hasn't happened. So
yeah.
It was kind of funny thinking in those three time periods, but eventually, I was going to say, eventually what happens is their community is overrun, because that's what happens to almost all communities by people. Either they're bands of brigands, I guess you would say, but they're much more savage than brigands. I think of brigands being. There are also bands of people who are addicted to this drug called, and they call them paints. And there's this drug, it says, that activates an orgasmic desire to burn, rape, and murder. Because when you're doing that, it's the best high ever because of the drug.
Sounds like a zombie novel, doesn't it?
Yeah, doesn't it? And so it then, so those people are completely senseless. They're much worse than the other ones, really. And anyway, eventually their community is overrun about halfway through the book, and Lauren and the few people that she knows or can scrape together, as happens in these books, then it becomes the journey on the road, and where you're gathering together the people who are like you, learning as you go, and winding up hopefully somewhere, because that's kind of how these books work usually.
Sure, sure.
And although this is an early example from the kinds I've read usually. But so when she's on the road gathering people up, I know things happen around them that are bad. And I know there's actually a person who dies. And in one sense, I guess I was left fairly unmoved by most of that, because Lauren is fairly unmoved, really, by a lot of it. And also because this author writes in what an English teacher friend of mine told me is kind of a classic style, which is that you can describe violence, but it doesn't drag the reader into it. You know, you're allowed to stay a little detached so you can kind of observe it, but you don't have to have so many details that you are.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I agree with that, because there was one incident in the novel that I really felt. And I'll explain that in a second. Because one of the things about Lauren Olamina, you talked about the drugs with the painting thing. Her mom was a drug addict, and she was taking some drug. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, Lauren was affected. When she was born, she had something called hyperempathy. Right. So she would feel the pain of other people. So if she was watching someone and that someone got hit in the head with a rock or whatever, she would feel the pain of that rock.
Yeah.
She would feel that wound. And then when a person died, you know, she would not feel that anymore.
She'd kind of feel the death part of it.
Yeah, she would.
But then she'd kind of come back to herself.
Right.
How could I have forgotten that? That was so integral to her character. I think because she spent so much time ignoring things so that she didn't have to feel.
Right, and that's exactly why she was ignoring things, or maybe that's why she would explain things the way that she was explaining them. But there was one point where she was attacked when they were on the road, and all she had on her was a knife, and she stabbed the guy, and the description was really visceral. And now, I mean, after what you say, this classical style, whatever she did, I'm really going to look at that
she
closer, because whatever happened there, I felt that one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what words she used, you know, to describe that as opposed to other things in the book.
That's true because mm-hmm. I didn't think of that. Because for me, the part that I actually felt was when she actually did get shot.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it a cowboy wound or something like that, where it grazed her side, but yeah, cowboy wound.
Yeah.
It just grazed her side, but it wasn't going to kill her or anything like that. And, but she actually really, you know, it hurt. She was
it was tough on her, because, you know, clearly there's all this violence going on around her. But not only that, but if she felt all the time like she would be a detriment to a group, mm-hmm. because the moment stuff starts to happen, she's useless because she's feeling all this pain and she can't, you know, she can't ignore the pain. You know, if someone breaks their leg in front of her, it's not like she can just continue. She feels that pain as if her leg is broken and does her best to keep going, you know, heroically mm-hmm. even, but still there comes a point where she'll pass out from pain or something like that.
Although I thought this was interesting. It's not if somebody's just feeling pain. It's not like it's telepathy or something like that with empathy included. It's she has to see it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If she can just not look at the person, she mm-hmm. doesn't feel it.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting. And she said that when she was little, until she learned how to control it, if she saw someone bleeding, she would bleed.
Yeah, and isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, because when she'd see somebody with a broken leg, her leg wouldn't actually be broken then. It would mm-hmm. she would feel that pain, of course, but
yeah.
she didn't have to have
that. That makes me think of stigmata, and we mentioned that from St. Francis. Yeah. So there's kind of interesting going on, which brings us to religion, which is the other huge part of the book.
Oh, yeah.
The reason that the book, even though it's kind of in two halves, the reason it feels to me like an entire journey, mm-hmm. one big journey, is because from the very first chapter of the book, she's describing her own religion, basically. She's coming up with her own religion called Earthseed. I'm sorry. And every chapter opens with something that she's written about this religion, like she's writing her own little Bible or something.
Right.
And she's coming up with these ideas, and they feel real to her. And as they're traveling along and they finally have a destination, what she's trying to do is create a community around this religion. Not specifically around herself, but really around the religion.
Yeah.
And their destiny, she wrote, is to go to the stars, which... It's an interesting thing to me, you know, in this thing, and I know I mentioned it already, but there was someone going to Mars during this, you know, so there's, the United States is sending someone to Mars, even though all this stuff is going on, they're going to Mars, and she's watching it on TV, and one of the astronauts ends up having an accident on Mars, and she feels a kinship with this person, and she kind mm-hmm. of ties in this religious feeling into that person and the fact that she wants to go to the stars too.
And I think it's interesting because the way when we talk about this and we say, well, there's a president and they have elections and they're going to Mars. I mean, those things are so unreal, even though they get talked about sometimes
mm-hmm.
that you feel as if that's on another planet. And yet they're in Southern California. They're not that far from LA. So it's not as if they're in the hills in the middle of nowhere or something. They're in a major metropolitan area that has slid off the face of civilization, essentially. And so to talk about all that other stuff, yeah, those elections, they might as well have been on Mars.
Yeah, sure enough.
They really had no connection with anything in their lives other than the fact that they were going to have to pay some kind of taxes. And if you were registered, I think you could vote. If you had a job, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And the central idea that she latches onto is that God is change.
Yep.
She says it over and over and over. I highlighted this little part that takes in that Martian stuff, too. She says, "My God doesn't love me or hate me or watch over me or know me at all. And I feel no love for or loyalty to my God. My God just is. Maybe I'll be more like Alicia Leal, the astronaut. Like her, I believe in something that I think my dying, denying, backward-looking people need. I don't have all of it yet. I don't even know how to pass on what I have. I've got to learn to do that. It scares me how many things I've got to learn. How will I learn them?" And then she says, "Is any of this real? Dangerous question. Sometimes I don't know the answer. I doubt myself. I doubt what I think I know. I try to forget about it. After all, if it's real, why doesn't anyone else know about it? Everyone knows that change is inevitable. From the second law of thermodynamics to Darwinian evolution, from Buddhism's insistence that nothing is permanent, and all suffering results from our delusions of permanence, to the third chapter of Ecclesiastes, to everything there is a season. Change is a part of life, of existence, of the common wisdom. But I don't believe we're dealing with all that means. We haven't even begun to deal with it. And that's from early in the book, where she's starting as a 15-year-old to have these thoughts and coalesce these thoughts into a religion.
Well, and I had that part marked also, and I want to read.
Go ahead.
What the heck? I'm going to go back a little bit and read the part that came right before it, because this is her definition of God.
Okay.
She says, "This is the right one, the true one. This is the one I keep coming back to. God is power, infinite, irresistible, inexorable, indifferent. And yet, God is pliable, trickster, teacher, chaos, clay. God exists to be shaped. God is change. This is the literal truth. God can't be resisted or stopped, but can be shaped and focused. This means God is not to be prayed to. Prayers only help the person doing the praying, and then only if they strengthen and focus that person's resolve. If they're used that way, they can help us in our only real relationship with God. They help us to shape God and to accept and work with the shapes that God imposes on us. God is power, and in the end, God prevails. But we can rig the game in our own favor if we understand that God exists to be shaped and will be shaped with or without our forethought, with or without our intent." Mm-hmm. And then it goes into that thing that you're saying. And I read this and I was like, ah, oh, that's interesting. It's like about two-thirds true. But it's but it's flawed.
Mm-hmm.
As a Catholic, I'm just saying, because, and as the book went on, and so I was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. I can agree with pieces and other pieces. I'm like, no, but as it went on, I thought, oh, I am watching somebody right in front of me come up with a pagan religion, because she really almost worships change. God is change. And she keeps saying that life is change. God is change. And then she keeps on saying, we're here to be shaped. God's here to be shaped. And I thought, well, yeah, she's worshiping or really focusing on an attribute of nature or of existence, change.
Mm-hmm.
But just because that's an attribute of it, that doesn't mean that that's God. That's just all she can imagine as God, because God is outside of everything we can imagine. God is actually changeless.
Yeah. It's almost as if she's saying, well, the only thing that I know is true is change.
Right.
Because it's not going to stop. All I know is that whatever I have today is not going to be what I have tomorrow, good or bad. You know, there is no good or bad. She says that later too.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing that she can depend on is that it's going to be different. And so she labels that God.
Yeah, because, and she's particularly insistent on the idea that people are shaped by God, but God is shaped by people. And that kept making me think of, I think I emailed you this. In fact, I'm sure I did, the ziggurats that long ago people would do, like the Tower of Babel was thought to be a ziggurat. You know, stepping stair thing, and it's flat on top, and the idea was, depending on how you built it and what you sacrificed there, you could call God down when you wanted by those sacrifices, and then God would have to do what you wanted because you called him. And another reason, the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
guess what? I'm not coming when you call.
That's funny.
But yeah.
One of the things that this made me think of, have you ever heard of The Secret? This kind
I've
of fad,
of it, but I don't
this fad
know.
Thing, I call
is
it a fad.
Is it this Gnostic thing, right?
Well, I guess kind of,
there's
but what
the
it would
the
whole
that
thing
only certain people get.
Yeah, but it was actually kind of a business inspiration type of a thing that they came out with, and it's basically, you know, visualizing what you want and in order to make things happen.
Okay.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of that, you know, if you know, and there was also some quantum physics movie that I saw that kind of had this idea in it that we can actually shape reality by desiring it, which is almost what she's saying here. You know, if you want God to be a certain way, you shape him to be that way.
That's a lovely concept.
It's a lovely concept, right? And what it is, you know, so this secret thing, you know, what it's saying is, you know, you sit here and you visualize yourself as a CEO. And if you keep doing that, you know, that maybe that's what you'll be. And I believe in some of that, you know,
right.
In that, you know, helping yourself be able to see yourself as successful helps you be successful because you believe that you can.
And it motivates you and mm-hmm. you can, yeah, exactly.
Right.
But,
and I think that's what's behind the secret, but the way it's presented is almost as if the universe is there waiting to be shaped to service you, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, the other thing I thought, and I guess this comes back to what I started with way back a long time ago, where I was saying, even though things were happening and I was very much more interested in their road journey than I was in the community, I thought that part lasted way too long. Mm-hmm. Just for me.
Yeah.
It was like, I didn't want the things to happen that did happen to precipitate her leaving, but I was like, okay, I get it. Can we move on?
Yeah, all right. I know this is going to happen.
Yeah. But, okay, I know it's going down.
And that's
come
what I was
on.
Describing about the end. I felt like something was going to happen, but it didn't.
Yeah, you know? And it was just kind of this gentle slide under the tree. Well, and mm-hmm. the thing that I was thinking is, when maybe this is the reason I felt like Lauren was kind of untouched by a lot of stuff, even though the book, maybe it's the way the book was written, but I don't know that Lauren herself really experienced change. Because
that's
when we meet her, mm-hmm. she's already learned to get her empathy problem under control. She's got her very hard-headed ideas. She's got the core of her Earthseed religion. She already is trying to warn everybody that they better have like emergency packs because someday they're going down. Her father's trying to help her see, yeah, I've already thought of that. Here's what I'm, you know, I'm teaching and not scaring. To get them ready. But I'm probably wrong, but I didn't see personal growth or change in her. She was always the same.
That's a neat observation. I hadn't thought of that, but I can't, you know, I don't see anything wrong with what you're saying at all.
Yeah.
You know?
And so, mm-hmm. yeah. So everything around her kind of slides around, but she's always the most determined, the one who never gives up. The one who just keeps pushing Earthseed until everybody else kind of either says, I want to believe because I need some kind of hope to grab, or I'm just going to shut up because you're so damn persistent. I'll just go along with it. Although it's never put that way.
Yeah.
Because they start to pick it up and talk about it among themselves. Only her, and I hate to say boyfriend, but I can't think of his name, the older guy.
Yeah.
He's the only one who's like, no, I'm old enough and I've been around enough that, that's you're wrong, but he's not going to argue with her.
Yeah. And that was, you know, very near the end, you know, she's always on it. And she says, God has changed right. to this guy. And he says, Olamina, that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And she says, it means everything, everything. And he said, you know, as bad as things are, we haven't even hit bottom yet, you know, on and on. But, cause that's how I felt. He was me, I guess. Cause you know, nothing she said made sense to me in a way that I would say, you know what, that's really, you know, a fascinating way to look at things. But again, I am Catholic, right? So I already have kind of a bedrock here that I'm standing on. So when I see that, I'm like, oh, well, she's dealing with what she's seeing. It just made me think of how these religions start up in the first place,
right.
you know,
yeah.
which is, you know, a piece of here, a piece of there. You know, I think that's what happens most nowadays is people just kind of grab pieces of what they think and then say, well, yeah, I believe in God, but, you know, God isn't a God that would do this or God isn't a God that would do that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in our tradition, we have, you know, well, if you go back to the Jewish tradition, we've got, what, 4,000 or 5,000 years worth of tradition building up to where we are, you know, tradition and thought. And I find it really rewarding to look at that, you know, and say, well, rather than start from zero and try and figure this out myself from what I'm observing, it's interesting to look at what other people have done in my own tradition. And it's fascinating how it all comes together.
Yeah, because everything that somebody comes up with where they think it's a new objection, I guarantee it's not, and it's been refuted many times by Jewish and Christian scholars over the years, depending on what it is. Mm-hmm. But also, and I can't remember, and since you've read it a second time and you were paying more attention to that stuff, I was thinking, because the thing that she wants truth. She's a very black and white person. She wants to see what's right, what's wrong, what's true, what's false, and that's what she's going to go by, because that's how you affect change, for one thing, and how you adapt, and how you survive. But I would say I understood her, because I'm more like that, but mm-hmm. than some people, I guess. But she, I don't remember, did she say that she had prayed? And I mean, because did she ask God if he was there or anything and give it some time? Because I remember her talking about her father being a minister and her father saying, if you don't understand who God is, it's because you haven't read the Bible enough. And I was like, that's not really necessarily true. Okay. Mm-hmm. You have to have somebody to help you think through that stuff. And he was a good man and he lived according to, you know, being a Baptist minister. I saw all that stuff there. But if you don't have that personal encounter, that personal experience, you're going to wind up with something like this God has changed thing, because she doesn't have anything else to hang on to.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the most concrete thing she can find.
Right. And I have from page 8 in my book, she says, so this is the very beginning. To us kids, most of us, the trip was just an adventure, an excuse to go outside the wall. We would be baptized out of duty or as a kind of insurance, but most of us aren't that much concerned with religion. So she's saying, all of us kids.
Right.
Okay. And then she says, I am concerned with religion, but then I have a different religion. So I think, you know, she's clearly saying there that none of the kids were impressed by the Christian religion or the Baptist
faith. That's kind of normal.
Yeah, and I think it probably is, too. And then, so, I don't know. So she took off from a place where she was already unimpressed and then went off in her own direction.
Yeah, and I thought at the beginning where she was talking about all that, at some point she was talking about why she'd come up with her own religion, and I just couldn't remember if she said she'd tried praying and never heard anything, which sometimes happens. You know, mm-hmm. you don't hear it. It's not the answer you want. It's for whatever reason, you're just not ready to even be receptive. But I just couldn't remember, because I'm not saying that she's just coming up with this for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
But in real life, in our real world outside of that book, I mean, that was the thing that I had to finally just go, hey, are you there? And I thought about it for a really, really long time. I mean, I was a young mother with little children before I thought of asking the personal question.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah, and it wasn't that much different for me. I mean,
yeah.
You know, Lauren's journey is not that different from what I did. I mean,
right.
I kind of rejected everything when I was 13 or 14 years old. And then that wasn't the end of it, though. It wasn't like I didn't think about religion. I actually thought about it constantly. But I was looking at all kinds of stuff, you know. So if I had come up with God as change or whatever, maybe I would be in the compound somewhere. I don't know. But I wasn't. But anyway, you know, years and years later, you know, I came back mm-hmm. to the Catholic Church. But I'm just saying that, so I think you're right in that this is not abnormal. It's just maybe her unique hyper-empathy mm-hmm. was trying to, you know, trying to explain everything in the context of that. I'm not sure, but I don't recall anything where she specifically said that she tried to pray or anything like that.
Well, and because she's born in a time when there really is almost no civilization. There's never enough food. You know, everybody has gardens. They're all kind of bartering with each other.
Yeah.
Meats at a premium, that kind of thing. So it's a time of want. You know, to buy new shoes is a great expense for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother does, her stepmother schools a lot of the children at their house. So they're as self-sufficient as they can possibly be. And there was a time period, and maybe 100 years is too long, but, you know, there was that time period after Rome was overrun, I think, maybe not by the Goths, but, you know, I know there was the Pope Leo, maybe, who sent away Attila the Hun, talked to him and got him to leave. But after that, I thought there was a time period where Rome was mostly ruins, and there were people in little farms around it and people living in the ruins, but it wasn't really a city the way we think of a city. Yeah. And this book made me think of that time period. I just thought this is the time period before it's hit rock bottom and something else changes so it starts coming back again.
Wow, that's interesting.
Or so that everybody leaves. And I just kept thinking of it that way because that was – think how horrible that must have been for all those people. And they didn't have paints. But, you know, Huns coming over the hill might as well be paints. They're going to do awful things to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And for no seeming reason.
Those Huns. So,
huh?
those terrible Huns.
Well, yeah. You know,
how did they get that name anyway, Hun? I don't know. I'm just joking. It's hard to be afraid of a Hun. It's hard to be afraid of a Hun. But, yeah, I know I would be if I saw him coming over the hill.
Yeah, well, I know sometimes I'll be upset and I'm like, oh, this and this. And I'm like, hey, at least I don't have to worry about looking up and seeing a bunch of, you know, riders coming over the hill.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've avoided all news, you know, during this whole conclave and retirement of Pope Benedict and all this stuff. But, you know, some of it still gets through if you're on the internet anywhere. And, you know, all this doom and gloom and the Catholic Church is in a terrible state and it's, you know, all this stuff. And you think, well, no, this is not the worst it's ever been.
Oh, man,
and
no.
And you're describing one of them right there. You know, there's, you know what, Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. I mean, he described a couple of times in history where, you know, things were pretty bad and the church may not have survived, but somehow it did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's just remarkable, yeah. And we're not even close to that right now.
Yeah. Well, and what I thought you were going to say, because since I was just thinking about civilization and not about the church, I was thinking about Mali. Those poor people there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, hello, Americans, would you help us? Well, here's a few weapons. We're busy. French Foreign Legion comes to the rescue, and I'm like, God bless the French. You know, these are real people having hands cut off and horrible things happening. And right now.
Yeah.
And I thought that's like being in one of those places when her neighborhood was being overrun.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. So, I mean,
it's not that far from some people. And I just feel so lucky that right now I'm not in one of those places. And so, yeah, so it's really, it can't even be called post-apocalyptic book because I think it's in the middle of the apocalypse. It's just a very slow
apocalypse,
sliding apocalypse that's just now hitting enough momentum that everything's going to go.
Yep.
You know?
Sure enough.
And it's just like always, the solutions that these government people are talking about when they do say, well, the president said he was going to do this, and you're like, What world are you living in? That's not going to help any of these people, you know? And then towns nearby are being taken over by companies. They're basically saying, big company, would you like to come in and we'll just turn ourselves into your company town? That will be wonderful.
Slaves and slave drivers.
Yeah. So then it becomes like the most independent people could essentially be called sharecroppers.
Yeah.
Because they're never going to get out of debt to that company store, literally. And they're slaves, slave drivers. If you're educated, you could be a slave driver somewhere because they talk about that option at one point.
They do, yeah. One of the characters is like, well, you go up there and do this, and everybody looked like, are you nuts? Why would you want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That reminds me of a book Jesse Willis read once called The Incorporated Man. Have you read that one? They did podcast on it over at SFF Audio. I never read it.
No, I don't think so.
But if they were, I'll have to ask Jesse after this because it's a fascinating concept. So I hope I get it right. But each person is its own corporation and you can trade and, do all kinds of things just like a company would, you know, stocks in yourself and things. So if you're like a brilliant football player or something, you know, you're worth a lot of stock,
right?
You know, that kind of thing. And, so anyway, it's interesting, you know, so everybody's incorporated.
Yeah.
As themselves.
Don't talk about that book too much. I don't want people to think about that because this company town thing, I just thought, yeah, first the stadiums and the bowl games.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's never the Cotton Bowl anymore. It's the Fiesta Bowl or whatever. You know?
I should break in. This has been brought to you by Tostitos. Tostitos.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now running Southern San Diego.
Yeah. Well, this is Parable of the Sower as presented by McDonald's.
That's good.
Yeah, everybody. Right. Yeah.
Well, but I was thinking about it because the race thing was most of the people in their neighborhood were black and there were just a few white people. Mm-hmm. And she'd talk about how, you know, in some neighborhoods that would be bad. But her father, who was kind of the leader because of his force of personality and education, I guess, just made sure that, you know, no, we're all friends. It's all going to work. And I remember when one of those families was going to go to the nearest town that had just been incorporated into this company, and everybody showed up to move their things, and Lauren Olamina said, oh, you could see that one of them was so happy to see that one of the helpers was white. That meant there might be other white people there. Because they didn't want to be the downtrodden minority. And not that they wanted to be the majority. They just wanted to feel like there'd be anybody there like them so that they wouldn't get picked on.
Right, right.
So it was just, but because of the desperate situation that the neighborhood was in, you really didn't see a lot of racial tension. I mean, she would talk about it, but you really didn't see it acted on much. Mm-hmm. I mean, she would just mention that that was a thing that could happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because once they got in the outside world, it was really the people who were kind of normal and could be trusted to band together and help protect each other and the crazies.
Right. Yep. You know, we haven't even mentioned, you know, it's obvious to us, but a parable of the sower is from the Bible.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that because she mentions it at the very, very end.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, clearly the title of the book. So it's interesting that she just puts, Luke chapter 8, verses 5 through 8 from the King James Version, right at the end. It says, a sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trodden down, and the folds of the air devoured it. And some fell upon the rock. Fowls.
Yeah.
And some fell upon a rock, and as soon as it was sprung up, I'm doing a terrible job, it withered away. It withered away because it lacked moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. And others fell on good ground and sprang up and bore fruit 100-fold. So, yeah, it's interesting that she just puts that at the very end. That's the last paragraph in the book.
Because she's thinking of earth seed, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
That because Lauren's concept was that everything of the earth is earth seed. It carries earth with it. So that when her dream of going out to outer space, her communities, going out to the stars to live happen, that's going to be earth seed sent out, like blowing on a dandelion or something. And I looked at this and thought, well, of course, even before I was Christian, I knew what this meant. I would never have thought of it that very way. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it's basically, these are people it's talking about, and how do you do when you hear God's word and God calls you? And I was just reading something today that kind of added an interesting twist that it was in this scripture study thing that I'm kind of just republishing on my Happy Catholic blog.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading it going, I didn't remember this at all. And it was saying that what we don't know is how Palestinians of the time of Jesus farmed. They would sow all these seeds, just like he's talking about, but then they would plow. They would plow after they sowed the seeds. So that gave the things that fell on the hard ground or among the thorns a chance, because the earth would be broken up and some of that stuff would be broken up. And so the point that the commentary was making is, if you know that, then you look at it and say, well, even if I fall among these other, you know, without moisture or among the thorns, am I going to let myself be softened up so something can still grow? Like the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, when God's trying to soften your heart. And I thought,
right, so your conditions are not everything. It's not hopeless if you're in a tough condition. Yeah.
Right. Because you'll be plowed into the ground no matter what. And so that ground isn't necessarily the last thing. And you have something to say too. Are you going to be open to when that ground is sowed? Or are you going to continue to let the conditions mold you?
I like it.
I know. It was really, I said, well, I put this on here in 2005. Good thing I'm republishing it, because I didn't remember this at all. And then you're reading that, and I'm thinking, oh, well, that really applies to the book too, because that's what Lauren's doing. Lauren is not going to let the conditions she's been sowed in say what she will be.
Yeah, yeah. Neat. That's great.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, I'm glad you liked the book.
Yeah, yep. Definitely.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent.
Definitely, and I would recommend it to people, and I might even read it again. So
how about that? Cool.
I have a big reading list, but sometime later.
As do I. Not enough books.
If somebody brought it up,
there are enough books. I just said not enough books, not enough time.
Yeah, not enough time, and obviously we've found many good stories. So right.
Yes, for sure, for sure.
Wow.
Hey, I wanted to mention one other thing before we go.
Yeah.
I got this really neat DVD that I just want to talk about really briefly.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Understanding Sunday Mass, A Kid's Point of View. And I really liked it, so I just wanted to share. It's for a catechist to show to kids. I'm guessing, you know, I showed some of it to a confirmation class that I have, which is, you know, 14-year-olds and stuff. But it's made for kids that are younger than that, really. But they got a lot out of it. It starts with a mass. This Father Jerry is out in front, and he's starting the mass. And it pans to these two kids that are with their parents, and they're both doing the eye roll and the dramatic sigh. Like, holy cow, another hour. You know, can we get through this? And then all of a sudden, time stops. And Father Jerry walks from the back of the church, and he says, why aren't you paying attention to that nice-looking guy up front? And he ends up, as you know, with a little magic remote control, he fast forwards and backs up and whatever, and spends a whole hour talking about the mass to these two kids. And as he's watching himself do it in the front, he'll pause it and say, this is that, this is this, and this is why we do that. And it was really effective. I thought it was terrific.
Huh.
So again, it's called Understanding Sunday Mass, A Kid's Point of View.
And your kids, even though they were older in the confirmation class, they still found it valuable.
Yeah, they did. They learned quite a bit from it.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. You know, so, yeah, it was terrific. Just very well done. Very well done.
Oh, yeah, yep. And where can they get it, did you say already?
I didn't say where they could get it. It's SundayMass4Kids.com.
Oh, okay.
So SundayMass4Kids.com. And I'll put the link on our site in the show notes. Just so it's there. But yeah, very worthwhile.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was good. Yep.
Good.
So,
hey, let me ask you something, though.
Sure.
On this parable of the sower, did you like it differently? You said before when you read it, the first time you read it, you weren't back in the church.
Yeah, that's a good question. My main memory from it was not details like God is change. You know, when I wanted to pick it, it's not because I thought, oh, God has changed, it'll be interesting to think about. What I was thinking about was the fact that she created a religion in this kind of a post-apocalyptic world. That's what I remembered most about the book.
Okay.
So I remember when I presented it to you, I said, you know, I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about this, because I didn't know, I couldn't recall if it was like just terrible against Catholics or something like that, you know, if it was just putting it down the entire time. But it wasn't like that. It was just her kind of presenting this point of view. So it was a lot different for me in that whenever that was being talked about, that to me was the most interesting part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
I always
I'm
slowed.
Just curious.
You know, yeah, that's a good question, but yeah, but I didn't recall enough detail. I don't recall ever being captured at the end of that book saying, "I wonder if God is change." I never really thought that. And I read this, you know, back in the Joseph Campbell days that I've brought up, you know, a couple times.
You were
too.
Ripe for the.
I was ripe
for, the
for whatever, because you know, hey, everything's yeah. okay, you know, whatever.
Right.
Whatever, you know, we're all just trying to explain what's really there. And so was okay. she, you know? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So now the parable of the talent, does that mm-hmm. take them further in the, is it the same group of people or is it some
well,
other?
Well,
do you remember it all?
I
can look it up.
No. What it is it's in, it takes place in the same place they end the book, but much later, not much later, but later enough. If I remember right, the parable of the talents is told by her daughter.
Okay.
It's also in first person, but it's from her daughter's point of view, and Lauren is in the book.
Right.
So it's not like Lauren has passed away and then.
Right.
But if I remember, there's religious fundamentalists that overrun the place. So, you know,
okay.
That one may be very anti-Christian, possibly. But it always seemed to me that Parable of the Talents was a higher regarded book, and it may be because it's anti-religious. So
there is
but
that possibility.
I got to look it up on Goodreads and see if it has a better rating. But I my impression was always that Parable of the Talents was higher regarded.
Oh, okay. Well, it may just be because the story's more developed.
Maybe.
Too, because she's already got this background stuff done.
Right.
And then she could just go on and do whatever else she was thinking about.
Yeah, and it's a shame.
I'm just curious.
Yeah. And it's a shame that she didn't finish Trickster, Parable of the Trickster.
I know.
That would have been an interesting book. Because I understand what her hope was, and I have no idea where I read this, but what her hope was that would be in the stars finally. Somewhere.
Right.
How they got off the planet, I have no clue.
But, well, that's what I was wondering. I thought if
well,
her goal
somebody,
was to get to the stars.
Yeah, somebody got to Mars, so
oh,
I don't
okay.
know. Yeah.
Next right. step, the stars,
that's
right?
That's right. So, yeah, but interesting. I find her an interesting writer. Fledgling, I have read. You mentioned mm-hmm. that your daughter had read that. And
she did
it's
not.
It's a tough book. I mean, that was a tough book. It was the last book that she wrote. And one of the things that was difficult about it was about a vampire who was in a young girl's body. I don't remember how young, but it was like an adult in a young girl's body, and there was some, you know, sexual things going on that should make a person very uncomfortable.
That's what Hannah said. She's like, there was a lot of sex in there that, you know, really, I didn't need that. And
yeah, and it's interesting in this book, again, we have Lauren, who's 18, and this older guy, so...
Right.
It's kind of a interesting. I noticed. Well, I didn't notice it that in the first read, but in the second read, I went because I connected it to the fledgling. So it was like,
okay.
You know,
well,
I was like,
and
oh,
the
there's
thing
a theme
I thought
going
about
on there.
It was, you know, when you said that it didn't really, and I know we were kind of done, but I just thought of this.
It's okay.
So, sorry. But the thing I thought, and you probably have not seen Beasts of the Southern Wild.
No, I haven't.
I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Okay, well. I'm just going to say this because I don't think it spoils the movie necessarily, but the last shot of the movie is almost like this book in a sense in terms of you feel like, okay, here's Lauren, this 18-year-old, and everyone, even the older guy Lauren sleeping with is going, you're just amazing for an 18-year-old. Oh my gosh, you're remarkable for being able to do all this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're left with these people all being led by this young girl. And that's kind of, I was like, my gosh, it's like Beasts of the Southern Wild, except there it was even worse because she was, six?
Wow.
And you kind of are left with, of course, it's from her point of view, I realize, but still you're kind of left with her having triumphed over whatever, and everyone's kind of there with her, and it's like she's their leader in a way, the way the shot is framed and pulls away. And I was like, in both cases, I just feel this is a little premature and possibly rather inappropriate. You know, just because you're the most determined in both cases doesn't mean you're always the best one to be leading the group.
Yeah. You know, that's interesting. You know, I'm an Ender's Game fan.
Oh, yes.
Right. Now, he wrote Ender's Game and then Speaker for the Dead, which is, you know, I like that book, too, but for completely different reasons. But you know, Ender flies off at the end of Ender's Game, and there's a whole gap. So what happened to the rest of the Battle School kids is the subject of a whole other series of books that takes place right after the end of Ender's Game. And so the first one is called Shadow of the Hegemon, and it's the only book in the whole series that I did not like. And it's for those very reasons. You've got a Battle School full of Enders, right? People that are like Ender, right? And they all return to Earth. Well, what everybody wants one. You know, you have the Iran wants one, and Korea wants one, and everybody wants their own one, right?
Yeah.
And the authority that they were willing to give those little kids was way too much to be believable to me.
Right.
It's like, you know, okay, I want you to be in command of my army. And that a general would sit there and say, yeah, okay, I'm good with that, without that kid having earned that stuff. You know, that book just, it didn't click for me at all. And then, but the rest of the series did. I liked every other book in it.
Oh, someday I'll go back and read it.
Yeah, and they just, you know, after that one book, Shadow of the Hegemon, they get older. And now things start to work, you know. Here you have, you know, a 22-year-old or whatever, and like, okay, well, that I can handle.
Well,
I can understand.
They had a chance to learn and
everything
like that.
So it just worked better, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe that's why I felt like the journey part, although it was interesting, it was, you know, when you think about it, all the people they decided to befriend, they were good people.
Yeah.
And all the people that they were like, well, this is kind of risky. These people are from this area, and they're going to steal our food. No, we won't steal your food. We're grateful to be here. And so, I mean, you get the situation where they try to get over, or they're almost overrun once or twice, but that's expected.
Yeah.
You know, even when people are like, she wakes up and she's like, really? You're supposed to be on guard duty, not doing the dirty over there. Okay. I'm going to have to wake up and guard everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody sneaks up on them. Nothing happens. And I'm like, they are the luckiest band of people ever. And that's okay. I understand it. But I'm just like, you know, it kind of took, by the time they got there, it's like, of course he's going to say, don't you go into town because that'll cause trouble. And she'll go, oh, for the first time in my life, I'm going to let someone tell me what to do. That does make sense. You know, and I'm just like, of course not, because that might, you know, put you in genuine risk, because then you'd have to react to something that you haven't prepared for. And I don't mean to, I realize now I'm sounding all scornful, and I really did like the book, but it's suddenly, I guess I'm being able to articulate the thing where I was like, you know, she wasn't quite risky enough with that character. And I don't know if it's because she was doing other things that she was more interested in, the author.
Yeah,
or
she was pretty much planned for, or kind of had everything under control the whole time.
Yeah, if she just loved her. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want anything to happen to her. She is the way she is, and here's the situation, and here we go, you know. Whereas The Reapers or The Angels, while also not a perfect book, Temple was out there in terms of
not a perfect
how
book.
How was she going to react?
What is a perfect book?
Okay, I'm saying that for the Octavia Butler fans who come after me with their knives drawn after I've said this. So
Reapers,
I'm just hedging
Reapers
my bets
of the Angels,
here.
I think, is a perfect
book.
Okay,
Reapers of the Angels could be a perfect book. It really could be pretty much a perfect book.
Yeah,
okay.
It was terrific.
And to hide my email address, would you? Jenny, I know
that's
you're listening.
Tostitos.
Jenny, I loved the parable of the sower.
Tostitos.com is where you get a hold of Julie.
That's it. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've mentioned everybody except Tamahome. I just wanted to get that name in there.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Tam.
Yes.
You know, we haven't mentioned Jenny from Reading Envy, who is a big fan of these books.
Well, that's why I just mentioned her. That's why I just said, Jenny, I know you're listening.
Oh, that's
so
right. Okay.
I'm just saying I love the book. So, excellent. Jenny from Reading Envy.
Hi, Jenny.
And I'm not trying to burst anyone's bubble. I know she's tough on a book. And actually, like I say, I liked the book. I might even read the second one. Not right away.
Yeah, gotcha.
But, okay. Yeah,
well,
because
all right.
I picked the next book. So.
Yes, you did. You picked the next movie.
I did.
And this, I don't understand. It doesn't look depressing enough for our podcast.
Yeah. I kind of looked at The Godfather.
Uh-huh.
And then I looked at Gods and Men and said, you know, I don't want to let these things influence me unnecessarily, but if we don't have something cheerful, no one's going to listen, and maybe I can't watch all three movies in a row. So, yes, Be Kind, Rewind.
Fantastic.
Michel Gondry directed it, and let's see, Jack Black and Mos Def and Danny Glover are in it.
Yeah.
And even Sigourney Weaver. So now there's a mixed cast.
Holy cow. That sounds good. That'll be fun. Yep. That'll be fun.
Yep. And I'm just warning everybody again, in case they didn't hear me last time, the first third or half of the movie is a little more Jack Black-y than we might all like, but it's still just hang on in there. It's really, really worth it.
Great.
Okay.
All right. Well, sounds good. Sounds good.
Well, I hope.
Okay. So you haven't picked a book yet?
Oh, I have. Oh, yes. Good. What Night Watch.
Yes. All right.
By somebody whose name I can't say. Sergei somebody.
I love
Starts
it.
With an L.
I am so eager to read that. I can't even tell you.
Oh, we are going to read all of them. These books are so good. Oh, man.
All right.
Yeah. If anybody saw the Night Watch movie, the movie is different from the Night Watch and Day Watch books, which are the first two of his, I guess you'd call it a pentology. I like that word. 5-book series. But you can see where the movie is derivative of the book, of the books, and the books have elements that, you know, you would recognize from the movies, but they're not the same. And they all are good. I'm just saying.
Great. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about
all
this
right.
one.
All right. Excellent.
Russian fantasy.
Russian fantasy. That'll
you know,
be my
very
first.
Very forward, leading edge-ish, you know.
Fantastic. I love it. Okay. All right. I'm just looking it up on Amazon right now. There it is. Oops.
Yeah.
That's not it.
Well, he's done
Night Watch on Blu-ray. Night Watch by Terry Pratchett. That's not it.
No.
Night Watch Book 1 by Sergei Lukyanenko.
Yeah. I like it.
See, all right. I love it. All right.
It's
cool.
Three novellas that pretty much can stand alone, but they're also linked and they're told by the same person.
That's cool.
And then the overall book has its own story arc. And then, of course, when you're into it, there's a larger story arc that covers all the books. So,
fantastic. All right. Looking forward to it. That's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thanks everybody for listening.
Yep. Thanks. Right. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah. Have a wonderful Easter, everyone. How's that?
Oh, wow. You know everything
God is
to
risen,
say. Have
right?
a wonderful Easter, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
All right. See you later, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.